I'm joined today by Shane Burley, author of Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It. Thanks for coming on The Old Mole, Shane.
Thanks for having me on.
So, Shane, you know, a lot of people think of fascism as something that happened in a very discrete part of history and almost 100 years ago now. What is fascism today? How are we supposed to think of how it connects to that historical memory and what we need to remember if we're going to have the motivation to stop it today?
So generally, when we talk about fascism now, we're talking about what some people call neo-fascism, but it's basically fascism without state power. So it's a whole range of movements. Some of them are insurrectionary and violent. Some of them, you know, liken themselves to being intellectual. But all of them seek to have some form of power over society that they don't have currently. And so the way I define fascism in the book is that a mix of really two things. One is this essential belief in inequality, that people really are stratified in their abilities and who they are and things. And that can be stratified along the second point, which is their identities, a centralized identity, like sexual orientation and ability. Saying that those things are not chosen identities, that they're not things that are forced upon us, but they're actually really natural and occurring inside of us. And so a fascist movement is really one that tries to reinforce those identities and inequalities between them to create a society that's hierarchical, that's separated tribally. And so when we talk about what we see as fascism, we see various attempts at reestablishing that, at confronting the current society and trying to reshape it in really radical and fundamental ways.
And this idea of essential identities can kind of be used to think of how male identity in a patriarchal society fits into this dynamic of hierarchical power and really kind of dominion over others.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that's really essential to it is this idea that maleness or femaleness is essential and natural and almost like cosmic and spiritual in a sense that it transcends a lot of things. It's definitely not a construct from where they're coming. And so it's the reestablishment of traditional patriarchal power in a really fundamental way that we haven't seen in the modern world. They want to actually completely revamp how we see gender, to take what we see as conventional gender norms and reinforce them in really radical ways. And that would mean pushing women into deeply subservient roles. And it's also arguing, for example, that men and women are fundamentally different in terms of their capacities, their mental faculties, and so on. And so there's a deeply kind of rooted hatred of women in that, in this idea that progress for women's rights or for gender nonconforming people is actually something that undermines the natural order and that it's actually dangerous and deracinates society. And so any of that progress and any of like feminine values that they identify coming forward are really actually something that's to be treated as an enemy.
And one of those values being equality.
Yeah, I mean, there cannot be equality in their worldview. I mean, it's so fundamentally different than the way that they see how society should be run. They think it should be stratified if it's to be healthy, that women need to be subservient to men, that men are built to run the world, they are built to fight wars, they're built to do complex projects, and that any way that you undermine that authority is to actually destroy the potential of society.
Of the species, even.
Yeah, the species won't go to the stars. It won't expand what it could be. It's going to be pushed backwards by these ideas of equality. Only greatness can come when great people are allowed to be great.
But it's not just identities in the sense of hierarchy among people's apparent identities. It's also how abilities are spread out visibly and invisibly across society and really people's ability to work.
Yeah. I mean, when you think about value in this really linear way, they have to look at people who are experiencing disabilities or are neurodivergent or just different in different ways. That has to be seen not horizontally. These aren't just different people with different skills or interests or personalities. They have to be seen as better or worse than. And so people with disabilities really do undermine their image of strength and their image of kind of a singular value set. And so that's the kind of, in a way, the purest form of their hierarchy is that they have to literally eliminate disabled people from interacting in the larger society, and they do not value them. And at the most extreme ends, they really argue for eugenics to actually rid the kinds of people that they don't find to be desirable, disabled people or people with mental differences, things like that.
Now, there already is, though, a history of doing these things to different people or kind of trialing them out. And that is what a lot of people have been saying about what's happening with the zero tolerance policy of the current administration's immigration enforcement. And so when people are talking about these things, they're not just kind of talking about ideas. They're really kind of like trying to make them happen, and they're trying to connect them to the real world elements that could make them happen.
Yeah, I mean, there's a real push in immigration policy to bring back concepts that that values certain types of immigrants over others and sees people who are coming in with different needs for social services or different health needs as actually being a reason to disallow them entry into the country. And this is a concept that exists in immigration policy for years and years, and we moved over time and through social organizing past those ideas and to value people a lot differently and to look at immigration holistically and to value the diversity that people brought in. And we're actually moving backwards further and further away from that. And so now we're having policies to get rid of lottery programs and instead look at, you know, how can we get more PhDs from Norway or something. And what we're looking at is people coming in with complex health needs are actually being seen as a problem for immigration and actually going to set them back from actually entering the immigration process. And so, like, what we're creating largely is a system that's going to value a particular type of person and that's going to disallow a whole range of diversity that we used to actually value for years and years. And there was a period of time when we rightfully saw the situation of people being refugees as a perfect reason for them to enter here, to seek asylum, to seek protection and medical treatment and things like that for their family. And instead, we're moving to a direction where people bringing, quote-unquote, their problems in here is actually an impediment to that. And instead, what we want to see is people that actually are coming in from wealthy nations that just simply want to take jobs or something like that. And that's actually going to be prioritized in immigration policy instead of working class people or people that can really, you know, add to the diversity pools of the society.
I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mill Variety Hour, talking today with Shane Burley, author of Fascism Today. So one of the big differences between fascism in our historical memory and fascism today that you spend a lot of time looking at in your book is the influence of the internet and other connected media technologies on how fascism, its ideas, and its eventual practical realization can be levered with the internet. How has that changed things?
I mean, it's changed it dramatically, not just in terms of fascist organizing, but organizing for everyone of all tendencies across the world. I think there was a period in time when political parties, traditional mobilizations influenced people's political ideas. But as the internet makes things more diffuse and actually kind of undermines traditional organization in a certain way, it actually influences ideas in a kind of a multitude. And it does it much more quickly and in a way much more completely. Without just having that direct engagement that we're traditionally understood of having with political organizing, you know, fascist political parties that mobilize people around particular issues. This actually happens around ideas in ways that are less targeted but maybe more influential. So people are able to stumble upon ideas. Different angers that they have, different motivations are able to be stoked in a long-term way that actually moves people along the ideological spectrum. And so as we entered the last maybe 10 years of political turmoil, the financial crisis, demographic changes, all those sorts of things that inspire especially a certain kind of anxiety in white people across the U.S., I think there's an effort to really stoke that anger, and it built up to a kind of a fever pitch in 2014, 2015 with development of the alt-right and the populist wave towards Trump.
In your book, you know, you talk about cultural and other sorts of public, not traditionally political expression, laying the groundwork emotionally and in terms of values for people listening to the politicians that are going to take the risk of proposing fascist policies.
Yeah, so ever since the Second World War really ended in catastrophe for the fascists, they didn't get global revolution, right? Society turned against them because of Nazi war crimes and the Holocaust. And so there really was a concerted effort by fascist ideologues. These are people who really philosophically align themselves with fascist ideas to start going after it a little bit differently. And they pick up a lot of what Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci wrote as cultural struggle. Like, how do we influence the way people think so that down the line they'll change their political actions and therefore change society politically? And so there was a real effort to build up cultural spaces, art, music, different things, that we go after people's sense of self and really start to change the way they view themselves. And the alt-right does this really concertedly. What they want to do, rather than just influence white nationalist policies, so they want to create a whites-only country. They call it an ethno-state. But to do that, they need to get white people to think of themselves like an ethno-state. They need to, you know, trump up mythologies about whiteness. They need to talk about European history in a way that's romantic. It's not necessarily factually true, but feels true. They need to create certain bonds and fraternal organizations. They need to do all these things so that before they get to that final end game, they've actually transformed the way that white people interact with non-white people and with their larger society. And this has happened all across the world, and I think we're seeing the effects of 60 years of that right now, where there really is, I think, and we see in American right-wing politics, this effort to like say, like, no, I'm proud of being a white person. Look at all the white people of the West have accomplished. And that, I think, step is a radical step that then pushes that political vein like further down the line. And so we're seeing this in a whole myriad of ways, and I think it's a little bit unsure of how this is going to play out, especially in the U.S. with something like Trump, whether or not that's actually going to push it much further, or if there's a disconnect between the kind of organs of the GOP of which Trump is still a part, and this the larger kind of metapolitical cultural struggle that white nationalists have been waging for the last 60, 70 years.
How does this intersect with the other, I think, big arm of fascism that we haven't talked about much, which is just kind of the armed populace and this idea that people have their individual liberty, which is kind of the mythological idea behind gun rights that they have to protect. And once you have those guns out in society, as long as you can convince people what they're really defending, you can mobilize those into these fascist movements.
There's a kind of dialectic in fascism. So on the one hand, it's elitist, right? It mm-hmm. believes that some people are superior to others and that society should be run by a particular set of elites. At the same time, it's populist, which is anti-elitist, right? It's against the elites we currently have. And so you need both of those things to work in concert. One doesn't really work to achieve final ends without the other. And so fascist ideologues, let's say the alt-right in the U.S. would meet that mark. They need the populace to really build up that energy. And they do have them. We do have populist movements here that are growing and getting larger. When those things are able to link up together, they're really able to take power. I mean, historically, that's where you have to find that concert. There has to be a way for the existing conservative establishment to meet with the fascist ideologues, and that happens through populism. And so I think in the U.S., that populist wave gives the far right a lot of opportunities. And when we talk about something like mass gun rights, I think the mythology around at least the white mythology around guns that we have in the U.S. is one that helps create that what we call like extra legal violence that we need. The violence that's enforced not just by the state, it may be encouraged by the state, you know, quietly, but it's the violence that basically is a kind of a white force to reestablish a reactionary policy in society. All those things kind of come together, and that's really what creates a revolutionary situation for fascist movements to really reorganize society in dramatic ways. And there's a lot of potential for that now. The problem I think that we have is that we really are in a new era. We are not in 1942. And so, like, we really have to think about this, that we are in uncharted waters to a degree.
And if demographic forecasts are correct, white people are becoming just numerically the smaller part of the country. And so by taking and centering the concerns of the growing brown and black majority of the United States, we are also really leaning into the potential political power that we have, the only political power that can stop this resurgence of fascism.
Yeah, I mean, they're demographically losing, and they know it. That's actually part of what creates their fascist wave, right? They love this mythology about white genocide, completely untrue conspiracy theories, but it is kind of bolstered by the fact that they actually are shrinking in terms of public identifiability. You know, the number of people who really publicly identify them as white is actually shrinking in the U.S. And so that white voting bloc, that white right-wing voting bloc, is essentially shrinking. That doesn't mean they can't do a lot of damage along the way and actually restrict the ability of working people and marginalized groups to actually fight back. And they're doing that really effectively in a lot of ways. And I think it reminds us of why conventional political struggle, electoral politics, things like that are stacked so far against marginalized classes and working class people.
Well, we only have another minute or so left. I want to ask you the question you raise in the title of your book, How to End It. How do we end fascism today?
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to acknowledge why fascist movements grow, and they grow in a lot of ways because of the same conditions that create radical left movements: class compression, alienation, the inability to find power in a lot of people's lives. And fascism is a revolutionary impulse. It wants to remake society in a way that certain privileged groups within, like, the larger kind of oppressed class try and gain power again. And so I think actually expanding that organizing base, expanding kind of working class organizing and the confronting of power and inequality and authority to include those folks and to create that narrative actually is a really important way to undermine it. And I think also to think of ourselves as a part of this group and that we need pragmatically to organize large masses of people to counter this, because we can't do this with just a small group of people. It requires a large mass of society that actually benefits from undermining these movements. And so we need to start thinking about how we bring entire communities in, because everyone has a stake in this, whether or not they realize it.
Well, I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I've been talking today with Shane Burley, author of Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It. You can find it through the Multnomah County Library in print and ebook form and through AK Press. Thanks again for coming on.
Great. Thanks for having me on.